Exciting news from the EAN. Since January 2025, EAN Campus is open to all associate members. If you're part of a National Neurological Society in Europe, you may already have access. Just log in with your MyEAN account at eancampus.org and explore top quality content. More details in the episode description.
Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Bonjour à tous and welcome to this EAN podcast in which we are going to discuss two recent papers on an exciting topic in HD research, namely somatic expansion. My name is Jean-Marc Burgunder and I am an emeritus professor in experimental neurology at the University of Bern in Switzerland and also a visiting or adjunct professor at three universities in China, and I do co-chair the EAN scientific panel on neurogenetics, and also I'm working and be active in the think tank of the European Huntington Disease Network. The correlation between the number of CHG repeats on the Huntington gene and the age at onset, specifically the age at motor onset, has been known for a long time. This is a negative correlation. So the more the repeats there are, the younger the start of the disease is going to be. However, there is still quite a variability for each age at onset. There are different repeats, and for each number of repeats, the age at onset may be variable. So mechanisms explaining these are being examined and searched for, hopefully to also be able to have some treatments for Huntington's disease. And old studies using brains from people who have died and had Huntington's disease have looked at the number of these CHG repeats and surprisingly back then found that this number, as compared to the number in the blood, which is used for genetic testing, this number may further increase in tissue. And this is what has been called the somatic expansion, which is a mosaicism in cells in the brain. And in recent studies, using large number of samples, have found that this variation, this increase, may also be found in blood cells. Now, two recent papers have been looking further at this mechanism and the mechanism underlying this somatic expansion. They have been published in Cell recently, in the last couple of weeks. One is long somatic DNA repeat expansion drives neurodegeneration in Huntington's disease. This is a paper written by Robert Hansacker from the group of Stephen McCarroll in Harvard, and they look at single cells from brain tissues of people. And another paper, which we are going to discuss today, is named Distinct Mismatch Repair Complex Genes Set Neuronal CHG Repeat Expansion Rate to Drive Selective Pathogenesis in HD Mice. This is a paper written by Nan Wang from William Young's group at UCLA. And today, I have the pleasure to welcome Sandrine Humbert to critically discuss with me these findings in the context of Huntington's disease and our understanding of mechanisms. Sandrine is a good friend of mine. We work together at this think tank I just mentioned before at EHDN, where we look for new venues, new ways of understanding and take care of understanding the disease and take care of people. And Sandrine is a research director at the French Institute for Health and Medical Research, INSERM, and she leads a research group at the Paris Brain Institute. She has been working a lot on transcription factors, specifically in brain development and neurodegenerative processes, and has concentrated her interest in recent years on cellular approaches of using a mouse model to understand functions of Huntington, specifically during brain development, and also to understand the changes occurring with abnormal HTT, abnormal Huntington, and Tintin during brain development. So together we are going to explore these exciting two papers. And my first question to you, Sandrine, again, thank you very much to be part of us now to discuss these papers. And what is your take in general, first of all, from these two, from my perspective, exciting papers?
So thank you, Jean-Marc, for the invitation. And as you said, so the these are two new papers with new ideas that are revisiting the somatic instability in Huntington disease, but with new technologies, because in both papers, they overcome the technical challenge of measuring CAG repeats at the single cell level, but simultaneously with interrogating the RNA expression in striatal samples from HD human samples, in the case of the paper from the Carroll's lab, and in mice, in the case of the William Young's paper. So there is a technical challenge that has been addressed in this paper. And what they both show is that there is a mismatch repair genes that are driving the striatal and the neuronal pathology in Huntington disease. So this is based on this long-standing idea that there is an importance, as you already mentioned, of the somatic CAG repeat expansion in Huntington disease that was initially identified through the genome-wide association studies. They found that the important variants, modifiers of the age of onset and rate of the disease in Huntington disease were genes that are involved in DNA repairs. And when these genes were removed in mice, somatic expansion was reduced. Okay. And as you said, the longer the CAG, the more toxic it is, to make it short. So basically, now in this paper, they are at the single cell level interrogating what's going on with the somatic expansion.
So you speak now about Carroll's paper. Yes, please do explain to us a little bit the major point of that Carroll paper.
So this paper, as I said, really link single cell study to measure the CAG repeat length to the transcriptomics of these cells, the way they express genes. Okay, and it's human postmortem striatum, so it's extract from HD gene carriers or HD patients. And so they found different important things. The first one was that they found major instability in neurons specifically versus the other cell types in the brain. And what they also describe is the way HD progress through distant phases of expansion and toxicity in medium spiny neurons, okay, that are the cells that are the most affected in Huntington disease. So it's a process that will take place over the entire life of the gene carriers, because they are not patient to start with. So it will start with a phase that they call phase A, where there is a small expansion of the CAG repeats from 40 to 60 CAGs. And during that period, the somatic instability is quite low. There is less than one CAG a year that is going to be added. Then you will switch to a phase B, where the expansion will accelerate, sixfold acceleration. So this will be above when you reach the stage of the cell, the neuron having more than 80 CAG. This will be followed by the phase C, when neurons that will go above the 150 CAG threshold will show transcriptional changes, Okay, so it will be, there will be modification in the, at the cellular level. So really you have to understand is that in one cell, in this neuron where you have more than 150 CHG, you will have transcriptional changes. Phase D will correspond now to a derepression of genes that are normally not expressed. And this will be above 350 CAG repeats. Also, I want to insist on the fact that, again, this somatic instability is present in some cells, not all the cells, and it's not corresponding to what you will see in the blood of these people. And then finally, phase E will be neuronal death when it's an elimination phase when, because with more than 350 CAG repeats, you will have a high toxicity for these neurons. So really the finding of the Carroll's paper are these two facts. The first one is the fact that this is neuronal specific versus other cell types in the striatum. And second one, you have really this sequence of events that is that are occurring during the entire life of a neuron, basically.
And this is which has fascinating me very much as a non-specialist in this field, is that they can actually look at single cells, as you mentioned. This is very impressive. And so they can separate those cells in these different phases, as you have said, and then look very specifically at not only the number of repeats, but also the expression in these cells. Very, very impressive.
And one thing I can add on this also, in addition to this technical challenge, is the fact that I think it's in the trend of the entire field, but one important fact also is this consideration of the disease for very long time, I mean longitudinally, okay, because you understood that even at the beginning when the expansion is slow, I mean, people have no clinical signs. It's really, but this way of considering it longitudinally is interesting, and we'll discuss that maybe most certainly later. It has therapeutical importance.
Let's go to the second paper, to the Young paper. This one used mice which have been transformed to have the abnormal gene. Tell us a little bit more also about this in a general sense on this second, the Young paper, the group of Young.
So I will come back to the, just to remind you to the introduction once more, is that the modifiers of age of onset and rate of the disease in Huntington's disease were mostly found to be DNA repair genes, variants of DNA repair genes.
And this was looking at these GWAS studies where a number of genes came
yes.
out. This, you are related to that.
Yes. And this was, in fact, it's kind of all the studies now because it's from 2015, made by a consortium of scientists. So what the people did in, the scientists did in the Wang's lab was to remove the gene encoding these repair genes in Huntington's disease mouse models and to look at the progression of the disease. So they chose 9 genes, which is already a lot to make all these experiments. And among these 9 genes, they characterized some genes are strong reducer of the Huntington pathology, disease pathology in mouse, and while others were moderate reducer of the pathology. Okay. So again, there is a huge technical challenge because to target so many genes and to have this, they have really very precise and new groundbreaking readouts because they, at the single cell level, they will again look at the CAG expansion. They will look at transcriptomic. They will look at, which is more classical than mutant huntingtin aggregation, together with neuropathological defects and some behavioral impairment. And what they did in this paper was, with this study, was to, so they confirm, but confirm is maybe misleading, but because it's not only a confirmation, but they show that indeed the mismatch repair genes are driving the pathology in Huntington disease mice, and they could pinpoint, they could decipher two of these genes that are of particular interest. I'm not sure the name is important. It's MSH3 and PMS1 that are the strongest one to reduce the pathology in mice. So that was the work they have done. So compared to the Carroll's paper, they are confirming some of the data and they are able to identify more precisely two genes of interest.
Yeah, that's very, also here, very impressive, all the techniques they have been using. And you have summarized the data very briefly. There is a lot of different aspects and which a lot of details, many, many cells and different approaches to come to those conclusions. Thanks. Can you maybe, these two papers, we have chosen them because they are looking at similar mechanisms. Would you like to take maybe a step back and try to explain what these two papers together help us in terms of generalization of the concepts they have put forward, understand our view on Huntington's disease pathology?
So first, of course, this paper are providing a better understanding of the disease in general, because they provide more mechanistic detail about the mismatch repair pathway in the context of Huntington's disease. I should also emphasize, coming back to your last conclusion, is the fact that they are providing the community with a large set of data that are available for further analysis. Another aspect that is particularly relevant in this paper, in particular in the Carroll's paper, is regarding the pathological mechanism, in that what they show is that most neurons for a long time will be below the toxic threshold because they won't have this expansion ongoing. So during this long period where these neurons do not have the toxic threshold, they will use the positive biological function of the wild-type Huntington that is mutated in Huntington disease. Okay, and this is to me, but maybe this is a bias of my own research, an important aspect of this paper, providing a better understanding of this disease, and which is absolutely key, and we'll discuss that, to find therapies.
Yes, I was always wondering when we, with the strategies which are being used to actually knock everything out, this paper, as you have nicely mentioned and explained to us, is showing that we would, of course, do something on the cells which have already these expansions, but we should be careful about those cells which do not. And this is a very key issue indeed on that. Would you like to elaborate a little bit also on what is the perspective for patients and maybe also about the perspective in terms of treatment?
So as you said, the perspective for the patients is the fact, as we discussed, there is no treatment for Huntington disease so far. There is symptomatic approaches that have largely ameliorated the life of patients, but there is no curative treatment so far. Lots of approaches, which we will not have time to discuss today, are focusing on basically reducing the accumulation of the mutant protein. They were unsuccessful, and recently the most promising approaches was to reduce the expression of Huntington using a silencing approach, okay, to use generic terms. And these approaches have failed. Okay, some of them even made the patient worse. Okay, so this study provides one explanation, because as you said, the somatic instability, this exaggerated somatic instability during life, will be sparse in cells. It will contribute largely to the disease, but it will be sparse. And the other neurons that are around this one that will have the abnormal somatic instability will need the wild-type huntingtin to survive. So this is an important contribution to the therapeutic, to explanation of the previous therapeutic unsuccessful approaches. So now, of course, this study, on the contrary, show that here you have a wider therapeutic window where even a modest slowing of expansion will be important to slow the progression of the disease. Okay, so of course, specifically in the Wang study, they identify, so both studies show that these genes are of importance to be silenced to improve, okay? And in particular, in the Wang study, they identify these two genes of particular interest that are MSH3 and PSM1. And they show that the reduction of these genes will have a therapeutic implication. And one could extend that to, instead of reducing the level of this gene per se, to functional inhibition of their the complex formation, because they function in complex. We could also eventually consider to find inhibitor of the substrate binding, could be, and all of this could be explored for future therapeutics. One important aspect also of these two genes that were revealed by the Wang's paper is the fact that one of the great concerns of inhibiting genes that are important for mismatch repair is the fact that you may have effects on cancer. Okay. And as far as the study is stating, they are known, these two genes are known to have relatively low cancer liability. And this is something that is also addressed a little bit in the Carroll's paper.
Okay. That's great. I like to come back to one point you just mentioned in bypassing, is the huge amount of data which has given rise to these very large two papers with a lot of conclusions and the results already there and conclusion or hypothesis building. But this data can be shared. Is it something which is usually done? And so people can go and ask the two groups, listen, we need the data for that and that purpose. Can you elaborate this as a scientist used to work on this type of data sets?
But it's even better now because it can be shared, it's that it is shared. So when you publish, you have all the link to go to the data set. Okay, so the data set are available now. If you want them, you can go there and directly go to the data set and interrogate them for your gene, your favorite gene of interest But in general, in addition to that, I'm sure that if you directly contact the senior authors of the paper, they will be happy to share more non-published data or non-published information for you to better analyze the data.
Okay, so Sandrine, tell me something. Maybe we should also discuss about following. With this tremendous amount of new data and being overwhelmed and enthusiastic, actually, at looking at the data and the conclusion they made, are there any concerns or any limitation we should also be aware about? I mean, the papers mentioned some. What do you think?
Yes. So as the authors are mentioning, for example, in the McCarroll paper, it focuses solely on the striatum. So it leaves open the question of what's going on in other brain regions. In that regard, I would like to mention the recent work of Natalia Heinz's lab, that is also in the US, who showed that somatic expansion is also occurring in the cortex. Okay. So I think really the striatum is particularly sensitive in Huntington disease. It is also the case of the cortex. So we should consider different brain regions. However, it contradicts other postmortem studies, which found expansions in the stratum, but no correlation with cell loss, with cellular loss. So these are questions that we can ask or to address. Okay, we can always find out why the different studies led to different type of results. And then there is the question of other disease with CAG expansion. So there are several disorders, in particular the spinocerebellar ataxias, that are caused by the similar mutation in other genes. They also show somatic instability. Interestingly enough, in these disorders, the somatic instability is very low in the region that is the most affected, the cerebellum. Okay. So it means that we know that there is tissue specificity in terms of somatic instability. Some tissues are more unstable as compared to others. So maybe the striatum is particularly unstable, not the other, which we think it is the case. But then also in other CAG repeats, as I said, there is no correlation between the region affected and the CAG expansion, the instability. So is it due to the fact that in other CAG repeats, there will be different type of mechanism? Or maybe it shows that, and this is also mostly it's certainly the case, is that somatic instability will be not the only mechanism leading to Huntington disease pathology. So all of this needs to be further studied. And the other stuff I'd like to bring is the fact that here we have both studies are are molecular, looking at pathways, at transcriptome, and the link to the behavior in mice is not very strong for the moment. So I'm saying in mice because in human here, obviously we are working on postmortem samples. So it will be very interesting in the future to link the transcriptional signature to the behavior. Okay. To see what will be relevant exactly for the patients and how they will benefit from treating this transcriptional signature in terms of behavior. That would be, it's not really limitation, but really raising new points of interest for future studies.
That's brilliant. So as a clinician, I will not dare to do that, but it's very, very good to have this nice collaboration in the field with different settings of work from clinical to the patient. So basically, the overall is quite encouraging in terms of the new results, new data being added. Quite a tremendous better understanding of this question of somatic expansion. But as always, there are additional questions which comes to be asked, which is a good way, like science should be actually going. So thank you very much, Sandrine, for this very, very nice and perfect explanation about these two interesting and challenging paper. It was quite a challenge for me to try to understand, and you have helped me tremendously. I'm sure I'm not the only one. Now, this is a big step or a couple of steps in advance in our understanding, but of course, complexity remains, has even been increased with this huge amount of data. And I guess we are going to meet again with new finding, and we can discuss them soon. So thank you very much again, Sandrine, and thank you all for listening to today's webcast.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.